Welcome to the Creative Hustler Show, the podcast where we interview the best artists in the animation and illustration community, creative professionals, animators, illustrators, directors, and more. This is the show aimed at giving you, the creative professionals, the knowledge to become better at being an artist and a pro. Now, here's your host, Rodrigo Flamenco.
Hi, this is Rodrigo from Frame Freak Studio, and this is the Creative Hustler Show. And today we have a special guest whose name is Callum Maid, although you might have known him as the Canepa Effect owner. This is a guy who has been pushing an amazing YouTube channel with a lot of information about anime, animation in general, about the studios, the directors, the music, everything that comes to, about animation. And we have learned a lot from his channel alone. He served as a video editor in Crunchyroll and OtaQuest. He is a features writer for Anime News Network. And he created the Canepa Effect back in 2014. Which since then he has been recognized by a professional spot in the Japanese and the US animation industry. And to be honest as well, like in the Latin America industry as well, as we pretty much are a huge fan of his work. So without any further ado, welcome Callum.
Hi, thank you for having me. Yeah, I'm probably your first guest that can't draw at all, but instead I talk about people who can.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that as well, because you seem to have like a lot of understanding about animation, and in many of the videos, like the way you explained it, how they are doing things, to be honest, it seems like you have even more knowledge than some people that we know that actually work in animation. So how did that happen? Like, how did you get there?
I'm not sure exactly how it happens. I did do like some classes on animation back in university, but I was never particularly good at it. And honestly, my main focus at the time was just passing the class. But since then, basically like everything that I do is way more based on what other people are saying rather than what I think. And that's massively helped in every area. Like interviews form the basis of all coverage that I do. I usually don't start making a video until I've found at least one or two interviews that can give me like a primary source on exactly what happened, because One of the biggest problems with how people cover animation online today is that we guess, because we feel like we don't have the information and therefore we guess. And unfortunately, that ends up becoming like just the assumed knowledge. I had a saying that I said once a long time ago that, like, when two people are guessing and musing and joking around, the third person who's listening in on that is going to take it all as facts and spread it around. So yeah, it's always important to find primary sources and find people that can explain to me what's actually happening instead of me having a guess myself, because I couldn't create anything near what any animation professional can do.
that's a good initiative and a good like value system to have, because again, as you mentioned, there are many channels who just cover things up based on their assumptions. And I think one famous one is Super Eyepatch Wolf. This is another famous channel about animation, and he did like a very detailed video about how Bleach pretty much lost popularity some years ago, and all of it, like almost all of it, ended up being wrong. And he recently has launched like a second video, like admitting that all of that was wrong and that he didn't have that information, and pretty much the second video was like trying to correct his previous mistakes because there it served like a massive misinformation. But the thing is that if you watch the first video, it just sounds so solid that you actually believe it. And but it wasn't like that.
I've actually got a couple of videos in my backlog that I'm like, this isn't totally true. So I've been wanting to remake some as well. Like, unfortunately, like, we get smarter as time goes on. And I feel like everyone has, like, things in their past that they regret and they look back on and go, oh, why would I make such a stupid mistake?
Yeah, but at the same time, it's part of learning and the creation process. Like, there is this quote from Carl Jung saying that the fool is a precursor to the savior, because when you are learning to do anything, like, you will look like a fool more than a couple of times, right? And you have to go through that process to get better at it. But something that even catches my mind is that, first of all, that if it is not obvious by the looks of your background, like, you actually live in Japan, right?
Yeah. I can. It's definitely the size of a Japanese apartment, as you can see.
And also, that has allowed you to put yourself in a position to get information that not many people have outside, because I think the language is like a huge barrier between this side of the world and what's happening there. And I've been able, like, you have just to the fact that you are able to speak about it, to speak Japanese and be able to even interview.
My Japanese is not very good.
Okay, but I've seen a couple of videos. I've seen a couple of videos of you interviewing Japanese directors. So how did you went about it? Did you do it in English?
English. Thankfully, I know a lot of incredible translators and interpreters and people who can help me as I get better myself. Being in Japan has helped a lot. Knowing the language as much as I should would help a hell of a lot more.
And how did you get there? How did you went to Japan?
My fiance got a job here and I came along.
So very simple.
Yeah. Like, most of, like, the trajectory of, like, because it seems cool that, like, I was covering the animation industry while I was in Australia, then I moved to Japan. It seems like a big success story, but, like, no, I just came along.
Yeah, nice. But it still worked out for the best, I think.
Yes. There is actual information that I've been able to get by being here, and I've visited a couple of anime studios, and, like, I have been able to, there is... The unfortunate thing is sometimes you can't say where you get information from. So there's a couple of things in some videos which sound like an assumption, which is actually something I know for a fact. But, like, I've got to kind of pretend that I don't know for definite.
Yeah, definitely. There are a lot of non-disclosure agreements and legal stuff going on when it comes to protecting that. So it's understandable. And being there and being able to pretty much have this channel where you break down how studios work and how they do the animations and things like that, what are the strengths that you perceive, at least from the Japanese industry, when it comes to animation that you cannot find in this side of the world, let's say?
I think the main one, which is constantly surprising me, is the designs. The fact that you have an entire industry of people who almost all of them have experience working with complex designs. When you look at a lot of American animation, the cartoons, so you've got very simple styles, but that allows you to go with a lot of different, a lot of movement. And I remember an old university tutor was saying to me that they put it very simplistically. They said, Japan does great art, but bad animation. America does bad art, but not great animation. But bad art, but great animation. But that makes sense on when you think of it in terms of like pure logic, but the anime industry does not work on logic. It's insane how these designs with all the facial features, like complicated clothing, how those designs are able to move so much and in such creative ways. It's something I will never totally understand, how a small island nation is able to produce some of the greatest animation in the world. I wish I had a concrete answer for like, this is exactly why how they're able to do it. But honestly, I think it's just learning within these spaces that has been able to get everyone up to like speed on creating incredible animation with insane designs.
Yeah, because to be honest, coming from Latin America, I can tell you like the anime industry took its lift off here and its success way earlier than the United States for many reasons. And one of the, like, I do get it, like there are a couple of animes where they go like extra with their designs, and because of like the designs are so complex, they have to kind of limit the movements because it's a pain in the ass. But at the same time, we have seen some really, like the first time I saw Vampire Hunter D, for example, Bloodlust or Ninja Scroll, Cowboy Bebop, things like that, it's like blown my mind. It blew my mind. And it's like, this is a like kind of a darker beat on Latin American reality, because at least I was born in the middle of a civil war here in my country, and pretty much all Latin America was down in some kind of conflict and bad things happening in the middle of the 80s and early 90s. So there was always a disconnect, even when we were a kid, when we saw like shows from the United States. And we saw, like, for example, G.I. Joe and Transformers, and they were cool and all, Ninja Turtles as well. We liked them, but we weren't able to believe it, because it's like, there is no way that these guys are shooting themselves in the middle of explosions and all this happening, and nobody's getting hurt and nobody's dying. Like, again, because we saw that in our reality, right?
Yeah.
And then comes animation and as long even if it was like all over the top, like Saint Seiya, for example, that was at least more believable to us, like, oh, okay, this guy is bleeding, like, oh, this guy just lost his arm, like, this is kind of how things work if somebody comes at you with a sword. And because, and this is like a little bit fucked up, but at the same time, it worked for us best when it comes to enjoying the series, was that because everybody knew that we were all seeing way worse stuff, like nobody censored anything about the anime. So we were seeing like Ranma 1.5, like completely uncensored at 4 p.m. in the afternoon, like Saint Seiya at 5 p.m., like no censorship whatsoever. And we were like, oh yeah, like this is the good stuff. and this is pretty much how things kind of came up here. And if you talk with many people from Latin America, they will tell you like they love anime since like the middle of the 80s or early 90s, and they will all mention all their favorite series. But it did cause an impact here, and it's like and it always generated the same point that you were trying to say, like how is this possible? Like, we know that the US has way more money, bigger facilities and all this kind of stuff, yet we see like this simplistic animation over here, or either the animation is completely focused completely for kids or going all the way to adults, no in between, yet anime had like you see the studios and they are like studios of 90 people, 200 people, and they are producing amazing pieces of work. And again, like you have all the range, you have anime and series and everything for absolutely everybody. Like anybody can enjoy this. And yeah, it's just like, we are trying to understand where that comes from. Like, why is this not happening on this side of the world? What is only happening over there?
Yeah, it's weird because Powerhouse Animation has been doing a lot of that kind of anime style stuff. And I think Castlevania kind of seems like close enough to an anime. And that's largely because a lot of the animators that worked on it are like huge anime fans. And some of them have actually worked in the anime industry before. But Blood of Zeus, which came out a couple of days ago, is kind of trying to capture that anime look without having the animation team behind it. And it's like, it feels like in some parts of the US, it's like this desperate clawing to try and like capture what makes anime great, but it just can't keep up. And I don't know if that's to do with the fact that in the US, a lot of animation is outsourced to like the Philippines or recently Australia. And South Korea is the most common one. And South Korea is where Blood of Zeus is mostly produced. And in the opposite case, although Japan does outsource to Korea and the Philippines as well, most of that core work is being done in-house with like in the same country with the set like face-to-face communication between people. So I can't help wondering, like, is it this historical reliance and outsourcing in the US animation industry that is that difference? But it's hard to know.
Yeah, and also I think something that has been being lost in this side of the world as well is this skill to do many things at once. Like you are going to find people who are specialists in animating fire or animating water or doing character design or background designs. But if you want to do like the whole thing all together, you have to put together an entire team, and it's very, very hard to try to find the people who can actually do the drawings and do like what we would consider now a one-man army. And like my business partner is able to do all that. Like he's able to adapt to many different styles in illustration. He's able to do character design. He's able to do backgrounds. He's able to do the animations and all this kind of things, but he was pretty much learning from the materials of the animators of all, like Richard Williams, Don Bluth, and these guys. Like if you see the old school of animation in the US, they do know how to do all this kind of stuff all together, and some of them are still learning. I forget the name of this guy, Glenn something, but he's still like, you see this guy is like 80 years old and still learning VR and still doing animations in VR.
Glenn Keane.
Yeah, that one, Glenn Keane. I forgot his last name for a moment. So it's like, damn, like this guy is like really old and he's still learning new stuff on how to do the new things. But I don't see that drive anymore in new artists. Like they are trying to become a specialist or very focused on something. And then I see the animators in Japan, and it's like you have covered many artists in Japan who started maybe as a storyboard artist and then went to production and went to do character designs and things like that. And pretty much they have all these whole skill sets. And I see that they have also become like very, very productive and efficient when it comes to doing their art. That again, like you will see these studios in the US where they have thousands of people sometimes. And then you have these studios with only 90 employees and they are doing like an incredible amount of work.
It sounds like good, but then at the same time, like there is the issue of they are doing an incredible amount of work and they're being overworked to hell, like almost inhuman levels. That like the fact that it is so common to have animators sleep under their desks or working way, way, way longer hours than you expect necessary. Like, there's some friends I have in the anime industry who, like, there's just times where it's like, I will not be seeing you for a while, right? Like, you are just going to disappear and we'll talk later, but, like, you need to get this project done. And, and I remember a lot of studios are kind of like ashamed of this or reframe it as being like, oh, we're working so hard because of your like, and your support will help us. But it's not a Japanese studio, but Studio Mir, who created Legend of Korra and a load of new stuff for Netflix, they're kind of tongue-in-cheek about it and uploaded a whole video of their animators just entirely overworked to their YouTube channel. So like there's shots of like a couple of animators sleeping under their desk. There's like a shot of like one animator who's like clearly in the middle of drawing something who's just fallen asleep. And it kind of made me realize this is the reality in so much of Japan. It's just we don't see it, and all we see is the final result. So I don't watch a lot of American animation, but as long as there aren't people sleeping under their desk, I feel like if you're able to make people happy and not overwork your animators, you're doing fine.
Yeah, to be honest, even on this side of the world, there is this word called crunch time.
Yeah.
Which is like when you have to deliver something at a certain date and you have like you have been delayed for something, but you cannot delay the date of delivery. So it's not as extreme as Japan. That's true. It's nowhere near as extreme as Japan, but it happens. And what I think here, what happens here a lot and what creates a lot of crunch time, and we even had an interview about that recently with a studio that's creating video games in Japan, is that many times it comes because of the bureaucracy. Like you have like a project manager or somebody like that who is dealing with the client, but this person doesn't know how to animate, doesn't know like the process itself. So there was a case that we discussed in this interview where the client says something, like the whole team of developers understood what he wanted to say, but the project manager understood something completely different. And he was like, no, that's not what he meant. Like he meant this. It's like, and the whole team tried to stop him, and he was like, they said that he was right. And then he pushed his vision of his understanding of what was right. They had to do it, and when they come to the client, like the whole team was right and this guy and the project manager was wrong. And now because of that mistake, he created crunch time where there was no need of being one in the first place. And that happens a lot. I think that for some reason, things in this side of the world has become like tiny gangs or cliques, like in the school. And some people like end up being promoted because they did networking right, like you could say that day, but they are not the best for the job that they were promoted to. And then they create problems for the rest of the team. And that's a lot where crunch time works. But yeah, definitely it's not as extreme as Japan is. And on that topic, I was surprised as well at how little they get paid many times. I'm from a third world country, like where most of the jobs are call center jobs. And I was surprised to find out that even some very exploitative jobs over here in call centers pay more than what animators are doing in Japan. When I found out, well, what? No, I couldn't believe it. Like, it just didn't make sense to me. And I did a lot of research and find out what that was true. And it's like, what the fuck's going on?
Yeah.
And like trying to go on the other hand, like have you been able to find out like how much the best animators are getting paid, or what is like the best salary in Japan for being an animator? So far we did a little bit of research and found out like Studio Ghibli was paying them like $1,700, but I'm not sure if that's like the top or if there's better prospects.
For like starting animators, like, then yeah, that's like, that's when you walk in and go, well, that's a really good deal. And it's like, that you might struggle to pay your rent with that.
Yeah, I know that the prices in Tokyo especially are not like the best when it comes to living, renting apartments and things like that. But for, let's say, if you have like an animator who is already experienced, has like an amazing portfolio, like what would be his best prospects? Do you have any idea of the...
I don't have like any specific numbers. I do know that a lot of it, especially key animators and in-between animators, it's reliant on how fast they're able to draw. So one of the big factors that is making it really hard to live as an in-between animator is the fact that they haven't built up the ability to draw fast. I know Toshiyuki Inoue, who's like a star animator who's done a load of stuff for like Mamoru Hosoda and a load of really famous films, he now spends a lot of his time teaching animators, and one of like the early lessons isn't necessarily how to draw well, but how to draw fast, how to like create the most amount of good animation within a small time, because that's how you survive. You need to be able to work fast and you need to be able to learn how to do that quickly, because otherwise there's so many animators who join the industry, can't keep up, aren't getting paid enough, and then just leave. And this is an industry that is creating so way too much anime. There's nobody that can watch everything that's coming out. It's insane. But the problem is you've got loads of investors across the world now who all are saying, oh, I want this created. So there's always jobs, but it's becoming harder to find people who can keep up with those jobs, who can like even make that decision of being paid that little. It's hard. I know there's some animators across the world. Like, the industry started reaching out to animators across the world to work with them online, but even some of those animators who were like oh my god, I'm working on anime. It's like, it's the most exciting thing. But after a while, it eventually gets to the point where this isn't realistic. I can't keep doing this. One animator I spoke to, I interviewed them for Anime News Network called KU. They work for Way Forward, creating like the Shantae games and stuff. But they also got contacted by a animation, I think it was like a production manager, someone for Sword Art Online. And they were like, oh my god, I could work on Sword Art Online. But they end up pushing themselves so much extra to be able to do this work. And it's never going to pay what it's worth. It's never, but a lot of it, a lot of anime is entirely relying on the excitement of getting to create anime. And I feel like as once that shatters, who's going to work on it? Like, if you're not able to like start making a living from anime, which is which can be difficult, then yeah, eventually you just get people bowing out and saying, I could work at a convenience store. I think there even was a case of a Studio Ghibli animator who was working at the local convenience store.
Yeah, and I think that it's highly probable that they are going to get to this breaking point where, because they have pushed too much to the extremes, like this should not be happening, especially in a country like Japan. Like I'm even surprised that the government hasn't jumped on it and say like, hey, this doesn't look well, because I have people who are living there who told me like, no, but that's not possible. Like the government here has some regulations about minimum wage and things like that. So how is that possible that they can earn so little? But apparently it is.
Yeah, a lot of it is freelancers. Anime is 99% reliant on freelancers who just don't work for the company, but a production manager has like a list of people who they'll call on at any time. And if you're giving someone a rate based on what they're creating, then you can get away with like, oh, it's not my fault you didn't get paid like a livable wage this month. I just paid you for the work that I asked you for. Like, even if those rates are abysmally low and like you'd have to create an insane amount to actually turn that into something that could be livable.
Yeah, I can imagine. And I saw your video about Kyoto Animation and some things that Netflix is doing as well that is not helping correctly, but it's a change. We could call it like that. Do you see like some sparkles of hope that maybe these things will turn out for the better anytime soon, or maybe it will just crash and burn and will have to reinvent itself?
I am endlessly cynical, and I have never heard any cries of hope. In case of Netflix, yeah, like Netflix puts so much money into the anime industry. Netflix puts loads of money into everything, and I don't understand how that works because they're constantly in debt. But the anime industry as a whole has benefited from the fact that both Netflix and Chinese licensors are injecting huge amounts of money. But you've got studios who, even if they are getting more of a cut of the licensing fees and are making more, their first reaction is, now we can reinvest in more anime. And I feel like it feels kind of hopeless. I did an interview with the president of a company called Cygames Pictures. It's like Cygames, the games company's initiative in making an anime company. And they, when they started out, they were like, we're going to pay well, we're going to not overwork our staff, and we're going to be a shining beacon for the rest of the anime industry. Like, everyone will be able to look at us and realize this is how an anime company should be made. But even them who have, like, so much money from Mobbygear and stuff, even they admitted they haven't been able to improve conditions and they haven't been able to meet their personal goals. And that's there's even a charity initiative right now called Animator Supporters, who they started out with creating housing assistance, which I thought was a really good idea, because you get a load of animators who are traveling from outside of Tokyo and need somewhere to stay while they work for these anime companies. And obviously one of the biggest expenses is rent. So these companies create dorms that charge them really low rates for rent. And it allows them to continue working in the anime industry, even if generally, like, in the long term, it's a bad idea because get a job at a convenience store or something. But their latest initiative is to create a new anime production system, which sounds good because it's all about like paying animators royalties, which absolutely should happen. But one of the things on their Kickstarter page is the words, "This will be an example to the anime industry," and it's like, oh, but it won't, will it? Because as we mentioned, Kyoto Animation, in Polygon Pictures, there's a bunch of studios that do that could serve as those examples. But in an interview with the CEO of Kinaba Citrus, he was like, "Do you realize how hard it is to like get to Kyoto Animation's level? It took them decades to get there, and it's kind of sobering because we see the good examples and we want everyone to be like that." But yeah, I'm endlessly cynical. I can't see it happening widespread. There's been no hope.
Okay, I see that. I don't think it has to be a lot with the production process overall, in very broadly speaking, because for what I've seen so far, like as far as I understand, like these guys are working live on a series. Like if an episode comes right now, the animators will be working on the episode that will come next week. And I see a lot of that happening, at least that's how I understand that works, the anime system. Like My Hero Academia including that, even the animation took a hit because when COVID started, we kind of disrupted their production process, and people were complaining about that they saw some drops in animation. It's like, come on, like this is,
yeah,
these guys are still doing an amazing job, everything considered. And again, like I think on that sense, like the US has a better system, although it is a riskier one, because they pretty much put a lot of money up front. They spend 1 year producing the series, so until they have most of it ready, they do the announcement of when this thing is going to launch. But if problems happen, and this happens in video games again, like Cyberpunk, for example, has been being delayed because they keep running into problems. And yeah, that allows them to say, hey, okay, something happened, we need to delay a little bit more and keep working on it. But that's part of the reason why they are not so overworked at the levels of Japan, because it's not like this episode has to go out next week. It's like, no, we're working on the batch of episodes to create season one so we can launch it whenever it's ready, hopefully next year. and yeah, I think that if that system was, if it was possible to implement that system into the animation industry, like things might run better, but at the same time I understand like how complex it would be to change like mentalities of the whole, like a lot of companies that are not necessarily in communication in a whole country, like that is definitely easier said than done.
Yeah, and even the US, like even the US animation industry is still guilty of overworking people, but it's always a case of like out of sight, out of mind. Like you hire a company in Korea and it's like, well, we didn't tell them to overwork. It's like, but you know how much work they've got to do, right? Like,
yeah, there was a series called Carmen Sandiego from Netflix that came out that they were paying like animators, I think in Philippines, like $50 per week. What?
Yeah, and it's always kind of unfortunate because like the way those separations work is like you have people in the US who are like doing the pre-production work. So they're doing the storyboards, the designs, and everything that's like, and then just sending that off to another country and then just going, okay, and now we expect perfection and we expect you not to like to do exactly what we showed you on the storyboards and just give that back to us. And it's like, that sounds simple, but it is so much more complicated than that. One of the best examples that I found out about recently of how this should work is The Legend of Korra had a big problem where in the first season, all of the animators were massively overworked. And the line producer like went and visited Korea, was like, oh, how are you guys doing with the show? And just, it was kind of like a nightmare. Like everyone's got beds like under their desk and like, here's the compositing room. There's the bed for people to sleep overnight. It's like, how is this possible? So during that, during the show, they gave Studio Mir permission to find more help. And then in when the same studio went on to create Voltron Legendary Defender, they were very like strict about it. They said, okay, we're going to draw designs that are a lot more simple. We're going to make sure that this show has like a certain amount of minutes of just CG animation, so the 2D animators don't have to create that much. And they also did something that I don't even think I've heard of before, where, actually no, I have heard of it before. They told them that not to do more than 11,000 drawings, which is still a massive amount, but it was an amount that the studio could handle. And now that I'm thinking about it, there are some anime that I've heard about where like an animator will go overboard, like they'll get really excited and draw like so many drawings. They've got like detailed animation on ones, and then suddenly like the studio comes back and says, no, you don't realize it, but we have to color that and we have to do like any in-betweens and compositing. Like it is so much extra work for like our animation directors as well, like to deal with that amount of drawings. Sorry, I went totally off topic there because I just suddenly remembered another fact.
Yeah, but no, but still, you were able to answer the question. But at the same time, I do think that one of the things that is in my mind a lot, because I was able or lucky maybe to come from the pretty much I dabbled into tech entrepreneurship for a while before doing an animated studio, and you know, like at the beginning, it felt like the same vibe, like geeks, technological geeks feel on surface, at least very similar to animation geeks. When you talk to them, when you get to know them, like they kind of have the same passion for creating something and kind of similar visions. But what I ended up realizing years after that is that because I saw how, for example, in the tech industry, if you go and learn the history of something that is called growth hacker marketing, this came out because marketers, when the internet was still coming up and still new, marketers had like this shitty product, but they wanted some commercial to help them to go viral when everybody was wanting to go viral. And from the geek perspective, it was like, but this is a shitty product. Like this thing will never go viral. But and when they started forming their own companies and things like that, and like, and this is the examples of Hotmail and Dropbox, like they were thinking, okay, first we have to create a product that is amazing. But then like you had to pay monthly for the service of email and it was very expensive. So Hotmail was like, okay, this is going to be free. And we're going to allow these kind of features that is going to make it awesome for everybody to want to enjoy it. But what is something else that we can do to make sure that the viral feature is introduced to this is, oh, the signatures will say like this email was sent from Hotmail, or Dropbox was like, oh, invite your friends and you will have more space. And so they were thinking first, okay, first the product has to be amazing. Secondly, the marketing has to be integrated into the product itself. Like how we can make people to talk about it more. And they were kind of thinking of ways to pretty much to make the fame happen naturally. And what everything stems off is that when you get geeks, like the concepts of business, they were into their geeky minds and they were always thinking on systems, like how can we improve this? How can we make this thing work? But an artist, on the other hand, is like they are only interested in art and they only care about doing art. And many times they never learn even the basics about business, and that leads them to take like very horrible decisions that not only ends up damaging them, but ends up damaging the industry itself. Like the example that you gave with the translation teams with Crunchyroll and all that, like they were proud that they were doing this thing out of passion. And the beginning, they felt like even guilty of taking money for doing something that they enjoy passion. And that's something that you find a lot with the art industry. Like they will feel guilty about taking money or charging money. And the many interviews that I have done, like the ones who are thriving in the industry are the ones who took their time to learn about business knowledge. And many of them find out like, for example, animation companies on this side of the world, they are pretty much expecting, they are giving you like the rope to hang yourself.
Yeah.
But you don't have to hang yourself. and many of them find out like it was very easy. Like they learned their contract. It's like they took their time to read the contract, to get another lawyer, to analyze it, to see where things were working. And they came to the industry, to the company. It's like, look, this part here, I don't like these ones. Can we change this to this? And they were like, okay, yes. But the only reason why they don't do it up front because they are expecting for the animators to just be like really happy. Oh, I'm working in Disney. I'm working in Pixar. Like, hell yeah, let's sign up. And they only needed to ask. But again, like there is some kind of guilt of, oh no, but this is my passion, so I should not be charging for this. I should not be doing these practices. It's like, no, you're screwing yourself up and you're screwing others by doing that.
Yeah. There's also the, as well as like passion, there's also the counterpoint of guilt. Like when you're on a project, like you want that project to be the best it can possibly be, right? Like, and sometimes that can cause you to overlook things like your basic health. And one of like, probably the most tragic examples of that it's probably not one of the most tragic. It's one that just came to my mind. But in 2016, there was the Berserk 3D adaptation. And that was like a series of nightmares in production. And with the whole thing getting stuck in pre-production for a very long time, it was like, it got to the point where they actually started making the show earlier in the year, like just like 6 months out from when it was actually like done. And there was a staff member there who everyone relied on. He was like this like genius who just knew how to get everything working. He was solving all the problems with production, and he was instrumental to getting the show out at all. But like, it was very clear that he was taking on way more work than he was hired to do, overworking himself to hell. And despite everything, despite all of the work he put into it, the final show looks terrible. Like, it didn't perform well. It didn't, like, it got a sequel, but the sequel had been greenlit before like the show had come out. Like, people don't talk about it anymore except as like a bad example. And it's like, when you're in that, when you're on production, when all of your time is being dedicated to one show, that's like your existence. Like, everything has to go into making this the best it can be. But I bet that guy now reflects on that and goes, there's no way I could have like saved it. Like, what's the point?
Yeah, it even got to the point that Adi Shankar, the producer of Castlevania, came out saying that he wanted to get the rights for Berserk so he could get the series done right.
Yeah, but, and exactly. Like, imagine like one of the staff members working on that and just like spent like years of their life just hoping that this would be the best they could be, and overworking themselves to hell. Only to just hear everyone else go, let's do it. This was a write-off. Let's get this other studio to do it, or let someone else do it. It's like, oh, I worked so hard on that. What was the point?
And yeah, and on that topic as well, we have been seeing a couple of news. I'm not completely sure how true they are, but we have been seeing that a lot of that coming up, that there are many groups or things that in the US that are trying to censor anime actively, because obviously Japan tends to have many times things that culturally speaking, they do not integrate well, especially with the US culture or other things like that. And we have been seeing like a pushback from Japanese studio. Well, you have I usually don't pay much attention to Twitter mobs because I understand that these are just a very tiny group that is just very noisy, but it's not that many people actually. But I did saw some kind of mob that was forming around a character from a series in Japan. I haven't seen the series, to be honest. But it was all because apparently the character had a huge rack and they were trying to censor that. And do you think, but at the same time, the point where I was trying to get is that you have been, like, we have been seeing this trend in the entertainment industry in the US as well. Like, they are trying to push, like, make everything politically correct, maybe not touch sensitive topics and things like that, but that now, thanks to COVID, like, you see the industry in the US and it's on fire. Like, the entertainment industry is a whole mess, part of it because of the huge amount of debt that they took when everything was going fine, but part as well as well because of the many bad decisions that they took over the last years. But on the other end, everybody was speculating in the beginning, well, it's going bad because COVID, people have little money and they don't have money to be buying comics or movies and things like that, and it sounded like, yeah, that makes sense, that kind of logic. But then you saw the sales in manga and anime, and they were soaring. and even now, like, you have the movie of Demon Slayer coming out. They just made $100 million US dollars in just 1 week in just that country because it hasn't been released. It's like, okay, then this argument that people weren't buying comic and animation movies and things like that because of COVID, it goes to hell when you see that the money wasn't going there, but it was going to the anime. And so that for me, that means that, okay, then despite the defects, creatively speaking, or in terms of fan base, of capturing the interest of fan base, they are doing something very, very right, or many, many things right, most probably. So how do you see this difference in, let's say, creative process, and how do you see this war, let's call it war, between these two cultures that are very different? Do you think that Japan will eventually concede to American standards, or will they just keep flipping them off?
Honestly, I've always, talks of censorship happening in regards to like US censoring Japanese animation, it often feels like those sort of conversations are overblown, because when you take it, like, I said before, like, my stance has always been to not trust my own assumptions, but like, what are the experts saying? What are the people involved saying? What is like the logic behind what's going on? And there is very few examples of censorship of Japanese anime today. There's dub choices that people call censorship, but honestly, a dub, I feel like in the process of translation, the dub is always going to be a separate product from the sub, and of course, obviously, original Japanese can be entirely different anyway, just because that's how translation works. I feel like licensors today, there was a time back in like 90s, early 2000s, where anime was making its way onto TV, and there was this feeling that anime has got to have the same appeal as cartoons, because that's basically what they were doing. They were taking anime from Japan and then just licensing it so that they didn't have to make their own animation. They could just fill slots. And you get to cases like Robotech and like Samurai Pizza Cats, where they just took all the footage and then wrote their own story to like somewhat fit the footage, but it's got nothing to do with the Japanese anymore. Nowadays, it feels like we've kind of settled into like an anime fandom, like an accepting of what anime is, and so licensors' priorities now isn't necessarily like to make anime into something that they want it to be, but rather to say people like anime, let's just give them that in the best way they can. There's going to be legal issues. I remember, what was it? It was Interspecies Reviewers, which basically turned out to be pornography, and Funimation licensed it, put it on their site, and then there was clearly an issue of, we can't really release this. Like, I'm sure there was like a talk with a lawyer going, are we allowed to do this without, because obviously they wouldn't have had like age gating or anything like that, because they didn't expect to have anything like that on their service. But the priority, it seems, has always been to get those things over. A lot of the censorship that happens in Japanese anime is done by Japanese broadcasters. So a lot of the time, the versions of anime that we get over here, I'm in Japan, over in the US, are like the versions that have been delivered to TV stations, and occasionally like one like streaming service in Japan will get like the pure uncensored version, and like of course like you get people pirating like, we want that version. It's like, most people in Japan aren't watching that one.
Yeah.
But, like, that... yeah,
I think I've definitely been guilty of that.
There's always going to be a case of like, because of broadcast regulations, and I honestly think streaming has gotten away with a load of stuff. Like when you consider like the movie theater, like there's the whole thing with like an R18 movie, you have to ask, they ask you for ID or parental guidance. Oh, is a parent going with you? Like all of those things. At some point, somebody's going to come after streaming services, because we've all been pretending that we're 101 years old for like years now. Like, eventually, someone's going to come and pose restrictions. I think the games industry had that issue for a while where. There was all of these like lobbyist groups who were arguing over censorship of video games, and the result was creating the ESA, the Electronic Software Association, to basically self-regulate. And I think anime right now is like doing whatever it wants when it wants. We may see a change to that. Hopefully not. Hopefully anime is able to just go on doing whatever the hell it wants, because anime is able to cover as many topics as it likes in any way it likes.
And again, they are very, very targeted to very a small group of people. Like, they know who, like, if they create a series, it is made for a very specific group of people. So
yeah, like Interspecies Reviewers was never going to be like for families. Like, it was like a lot of these shows, they're not meant for everyone. And I think then you get that issue where it's like anyone, when you bring these things to the US, like it becomes for everyone. Most of the time that just means nobody ends up watching like the latest like idol show that like is from like this idol project that a load of people in Japan like, that there's a hardcore group of people that love it in Japan, but like you bring it over to the West, it's like, why would we care about this? But yeah, there's also going to be the more risque stuff that it's going to be more difficult to bring over, because it's not for people who don't know what they're getting into.
I'm on Apocalypse of Devilman. The first time I saw that movie, it's like, yep, I'm definitely never going to see anything like this coming from the US industry.
yeah, because like a lot of anime is adaptation, so everyone knows like Devilman, like it's a Go Nagai work, and so everyone kind of like has this idea of what's going into it. But yeah, as you said, like when you watch it outside of that concert, it's like, oh my god, what the hell is this? Yeah, I've watched a couple of Go Nagai works like in the past. I'm like, what the hell is going on? But
I also have given up hopes completely that Gantz is going to get like a good adaptation anytime soon.
I'm a fan of Gantz O, like the CG anime, because the studio is really good, but like, yeah, you're not really going to get like the full nitty and gritty adaptations. I mean, it's hard enough to adapt a whole story as it is, but then like you have Gantz where suddenly it's like, who is going to be able to watch this? The US loves gore. I feel like they would bring Gantz to the US. I could even see the US company co-funding it. But then you have the issue of the US isn't necessarily the biggest market for anime. China is. And so if you're going to rely on like making back a load of money, you're going to have to tackle with the fact that you've got a load of Chinese licensors who absolutely love this stuff. Like China is the country with the most anime fans in the world who eat this stuff up. But the licensors will pay for it, pay loads of money for it, and then suddenly you get government censors coming up to them and saying, yeah, you're going to have to take this off your service. And they're like, we paid for the whole thing. Like, we're only on like episode 2 and you're already like taking this off, which has made, there was a lot of excitement a few years ago about like the Chinese anime market. And I mean, I don't know that much about Chinese economics, but like this creation of a Chinese middle class who are now like watching and buying more entertainment products. And so, but yeah, since then, the revenue coming from China has kind of dialed back as licensors and investors start to get more wary about censors there. So yeah, I would also love to see a proper full adaptation of Gantz, but there's factors in the anime industry that is going to stop something that expensive and difficult to create from going ahead. Not to say that it still doesn't happen. There are plenty of anime with like a load of gore and sex and all kind of things that managed to get adapted, but I think naturally those are going to remain being for niche audiences, unless you get a deal with Netflix, and then suddenly everything changes.
A show that I wanted to touch on is on this kind of topic on how to manage this kind of censorship from maybe China. I know that with Gantz is really, really hard to do, but
yeah,
the Batman the Animated Series did a lot of tricks because, again, by the time when it was coming up, censorship in the US by the government was a little bit stronger. And like, for example, things that they were not allowed to show was like guns. So how they, like the way how they did jump over that was to put like the gang Thompson machine guns into the series, because like it was very, it wasn't probable at all that the father or something like that will have that kind of guns into their house. So that way they were able to overcome that kind of censorship, or they will create some scene like really outrageous in an episode that the censors will like completely focus over that and take that out, so they could ignore another scene that was like,
yeah,
like,
that's always really edgy. The weird thing, because like there was that specific phrase, like repeatable violence, like things that people could see on TV and repeat at home. And it's like, and sometimes it ends up like meaning like, okay, they'll have like wild, crazy, like weapons that nobody would have at home. But it's like, it's weird. Honestly, I was kind of, I'm kind of impressed with like the 4Kids and all those censors at the time, because like, they didn't just license anime, they redrew it. And that is the weirdest thing to me, that like, because they wouldn't have asked for the show, they would have asked for like the show's materials so they could basically recreate the show. It was so much extra effort to create something that nobody liked.
Yeah, definitely. And on your opinion, what will distinguish more the technical level from an animator in Japan, I create an anime, compared to an animator from the side of the world creating cartoons, like besides the obvious the difference of style, like what do you think will be the key things that will differentiate one from another?
What do you mean, like I mean, outside of style, like...
Well, for just to give an example, you mentioned that the best animators have the ability of creating a lot of drawings really, really fast. And for example, I have seen videos of Horikoshi or other creators from anime that they pretty much create the drawings from one go. And I assume that comes from doing the manga over and over and over and again. And they know the characters so much that they can just draw it. You can see it drawn live and the drawing comes perfectly in one go. And on the other hand, like, I don't see that happening a lot, let's say in the US, but things like that, what things do you think that differentiates what would be considered a good animator in Japan versus an animator in the West?
I think there is a tendency, I'd always go as far as to say an obsession with having things on model in the US. Oh my God, there's a phrase, I'm from Australia, I'm from England than Australia, and so I should know more about the animation that airs in my country and is created in my country, but in fact, I know more about Japanese animation. So when I first heard the term, like, I think it was tie-down animation, which is the, as far as I'm aware, it's the idea of, like, you've created the animation, but now it needs to go on the model. So, like, it's kind of this obsession of, okay, you've done great work, however, now we need to make sure that it's exactly the same as the final, as the original character designs. And animators in Japan will have their little desks and they'll have, like, the character designs for the show taped up above them, but they don't necessarily have the, they're not specifically going to follow the model. Instead, you're going to have the animation director do some changes, but often they want to keep the appeal of the original animation, even if it goes off model constantly. Like, it's, there's a preference towards, like, having things that be exciting and moving all the time, even if it doesn't exactly look like the same character design anymore. And there's even the extreme example of character designer and chief animation director of Konosuba called Koichi Kikusa, and he takes that philosophy to an extreme where he's like, I refuse to correct people's animation. If you want to go off model, go as off model as you want. Like, go crazy with it. And it's a philosophy that there is some animation in the US that's created like that. But I feel like a Koichi Kikuta who moves to work at Nickelodeon Studios is the sort of guy who, like, they push off into the corner and don't let him, like, do animation. Like, stop ruining the character designs. Everyone knows this character as this. But,
yeah, there are a lot of rules that we consider stupid.
Does everything have to fit that specific design that, like, was created, like, a year ago? It's like, let's have a bit of fun with it.
Yeah, and the most extreme, I think, it will be Disney. Like, if you see the graphical assets created for the initial designs of Frozen, they were so good. If you go and get the art book from Frozen and see the concept arts, the initial concept arts, they were amazing. And then they changed everything to fit, like, the kind of Barbie doll style. Yeah. It's like, what? Like, this is clearly better. Why? It's like, it's because the algorithm from marketing says that this will sell more. And stuff.
It's always funny to me that CG anime is because CG anime isn't necessarily inspired by Pixar, but instead it is inspired by 2D anime. So you get like these cases where CG animators are like stretching the models in all like weird ways, just so like, oh, it looks like a 2D character now. It's like, yeah, but like, I can imagine someone at Disney seeing that and going, what the hell are you doing to those models? That's not on model anymore. Why have you, like, it's like, it is one of the coolest things about 3D anime to me, the fact that they are so enamored with 2D animation that they'll go to crazy lengths that would break a lot of supposed rules to like make things feel like the 2D anime that everyone has like grown accustomed to.
Yeah, definitely. And to be closing this interview, do you have any advice for young artists who want to get to be as a professional, but they are still like in this fantasy land that is the world of animation and are not exposed to the brutal realities of it as well?
It's hard for me to say because, yeah, I don't work in the animation industry. I cannot draw at all. So it feels presumptuous of me to like be giving advice, but based on the things that I've learned, follow the money instead. Like, know when to manage your passions. Know when something is to live and when something is for fun. And as KU, who I mentioned before, who like managed to overwork themselves by working their day job and working on anime, they said, "Do not be like me." Like, empathy in animation is really important, especially when you're working with outsourcing studios. Realize that when you're drawing in credit, that like when you're drawing storyboards, that somebody has to animate that frame by frame, and so empathizing with other people, even if they're not within your immediate vicinity, doing things that work best for your health. Even if it's taking jobs at companies that you don't think will be that interesting, opposed, like, think about your future self. Like, I feel like we have a habit of, like, we get involved in things because we're really passionate about them at the start, but I feel like passion dies quickly when you're overworked. I love what I do. I cover the animation industry for a lot of different places. It doesn't mean that I don't still work a full day of work and sometimes get exhausted. Like, I think it's good to imagine a future where you're sick of this and see, is that sustainable?
Yeah, that is definitely a good advice. I also give advice to similar kind of a model that say that when we want to start something, usually we are in this hype state, but it's good to realize that you should remember that you're not always at that state. Yeah. In fact, like, you're almost never at that hype state, like you're on a regular level. But other than that, you will also have some really, 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 really bad days. And
yeah.
And the way that you should plan the things that you should do, that should not be going for the best of your days. Like when you're hype, like, yeah, I'm going to do this. It should be planned based on when you're feeling really, really bad. Like, try to imagine your worst day and then think like, if I was feeling like all these horrible things inside, will I be able to do this? And if the answer is yes, then you have like a sustainable model for the long term.
Yeah, I once did a job. I once got offered to do a job where it would be involved creating a video to promote an upcoming anime. And I was so excited about this anime, and I thought this is a great, like, great opportunity. I like created, like, they had a deadline of like basically the next day. So I spent like all day making this video to highlight the production and what's exciting about this upcoming anime. And by the end of it, I realized I'd never asked if I was going to get paid for it. And they never intended on paying me for it. And it is like, I mean, it was only one day, but like, I felt so stupid afterwards. I was like, what the hell am I doing? Like, yes, it was great to like help promote this film, and the video got like thousands of views and tens of thousands. I can't even remember. But like, eventually it gets to the point where it's like, what was the point of any of that?
Yeah, I think it's really important to know this. Lastly, and this is probably more like a selfish question, because I run an interview show, how did you go about contacting the animators or these people and finding all this information about these studios?
Well, it helps if you get engaged to someone who can speak Japanese. genuinely, there's like so much of my channel wouldn't be where it is without my fiance. But in terms of getting in contact, oh, this is probably awful advice, but if you can find an email address that is directly to an artist and not to the company they're working for, then even if you eventually have to go past the company, it is like a dream come true. There is one awful example, but Yuichi Terrell, who like does the compositing for Yuffie Table shows, including the new Demon Slayer, like all of the digital effects, all the lighting, like he's probably one of the most influential compositors in the entire anime industry. He did an interview with a different website, but the website weirdly, instead of like posting the interview properly formatted with images and everything, just copied and pasted the entire email. So what I did is I found that they'd included his email address in it. And so I decided to contact that email address directly. This was a Hotmail account. And he responded really well to it and then said, okay, but could you email me at my work email address? Also, I'll like CC in like my boss and then we'll do this properly. And like, terrible advice, but it works. Like a lot of animators are on Twitter nowadays, to be honest. But like, there's a lot of people who like have public email addresses. And if you can find those instead of trying to go through the companies, because the companies are always going to be a pain in the ass. And if you don't have like a huge outlet that will impress a company, what you can instead go for the strategy for is impressing us individual staff members with the sort of things you want to ask them, like showing an, I've realized that showing an understanding of animation to, showing an understanding of animation to people in the animation industry is the easiest way to get them on your side. And like, in fact, that's one of the reasons I went on this podcast, because I was like, you are someone who understands the animation industry, so it's going to be more fun to talk to you.
Definitely. Yeah, I really like your hustle. To be honest, I have done things like that as well. And I even have software that can, like, if I get your LinkedIn ID, your LinkedIn page, I can extract your email from it.
Yeah. I mean, you contacted me through my Patreon. Nobody's ever done that before.
Yeah, I tried to find your email and I wasn't able to do it. So, okay, then there's a Patreon. I will become a patron and contacting you there.
I should have a public email address. I should make one. I was thinking of doing one when the channel finally hits 100,000 subscribers as like a kind of like if you want to sponsor me, now do it.
Definitely. Well, I really appreciate that you have given us your time, your expertise here, so that more people can learn about the industry. I think that even though some problems are very specific to Japan, there are themes there that are heavily common in any industry when it comes to creative work, and they could definitely use this advice to kind of not mess up with their careers.
hopefully.
So I really thank you, and for, well, probably your channel is already known by many people who watch this interview, but for those who don't know, if you want to find this channel, The Canipa Effect, in YouTube, you will be able to find a lot of studio like studio analysis, animation director analysis, things like that. There's a lot to learn there. We do not have a university or a school that teaches art properly in our country, so we heavily depend on channels like yours to learn a lot and implement the things that we captured there into our animations as well. So I really thank you for the work that you have put up.
Thank you very much.
It really has helped us with a lot of new ideas as well. And also, if you want to find him on Twitter, you can look in Canipa Show. Also, his Patreon is The Canipa Effect. So if you want to become his patron and help him to produce more videos, please do so.
Or use it to invite me to a podcast.
Definitely. So thanks a lot, Callum. It has been great to have you here. And definitely, I think this will help a lot of people.
Yeah, thank you very much for inviting me.
So this has been the last episode of the Creative Hustler Show. I hope you like it a lot. And if you have, please click the like button below and subscribe to our channel. Or if you're listening from the podcast, then just subscribe to our podcast so you can be notified when we publish the next interview. Until next time.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Creative Hustler Show. We hope you enjoyed this episode. If so, don't forget to share and subscribe. For more info, check out www.brainfreakstudio.com. See you in the next episode.